This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, March 17th, 2014. Happy St. Patrick's Day. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Ozarks at Large is supported by the Center for Arkansas and Regional Studies at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, dedicated to the celebration and documentation of this region's history and culture. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, a conversation with the author of The Meat Racket, The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business. The book traces how Tyson Foods grew from a family business, as well as how the business of poultry farming has changed during the past few decades. We'll also have a conversation with the CEO of Tyson, Donnie Smith. Those stories and more. But first, a company that will manage operations of Entergy's Arkansas Power Grid broke ground on a new facility Friday in Little Rock. The Mid-Continent Independent System Operator, or MISO, is establishing the regional headquarters that company officials say will employ 50 people with average annual salaries of $85,000. Governor Mike Beebe, who was on hand for the ceremony, says the company needs highly skilled, technologically oriented workers.
I liken what this is all about to air traffic controllers for electrons. They're going to be directing those electrons throughout multiple miles of systems with engineers and highly qualified, highly educated people to be able to deliver reliable, cost-effective energy.
Construction on the $22 million facility is expected to be complete next spring. The state of Arkansas will provide incentives to MISO for every employee it hires over a four-year period. Arkansas's jobless rate edged downward in January. According to data from the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics, the jobless rate for the month was 7.3%, representing nearly 97,000 people out of work in the state. That represents a decrease of 0.1% and 1,700 fewer unemployed people. Joblessness also declined on a year-over-year basis. One year ago, the state's jobless rate was at 7.5%, with more than 99,000 people unemployed. The Fayetteville City Council tomorrow night will again consider an ordinance aimed at increasing residents' ability to grow and sell agricultural goods on their property within the city. Peter Nierengarten, the city's director of sustainability and strategic planning, says the ordinance is a series of changes to four areas of the city's unified development code.
They're divided into two areas, changes that would help promote and enable on-site sales of homegrown and home-produced agricultural products through some changes to the definition of what's allowable under a garage sale. And then also changes to our definition of a home occupation so that you could sell these home-produced agricultural products from your home.
The other area on which the Urban Agriculture Ordinance focuses is the city's fowl and animal ordinance. Those changes, depending on the size of the property in question, would allow residents to keep a certain number of chickens and goats. But Nierengarten says some restrictions would still be in place for those hoping to keep backyard animals.
Roosters are not allowed inside the city limits under this ordinance, so any roosters would be, there would be a notice of violation issued for roosters, and we're requiring that property owners have secure fences for their goats that would keep their goats contained, and if their goats are not able to be contained, then there's an avenue for issuing citations for animals that are at large.
The Urban Agriculture Ordinance was tabled at the previous City Council meeting. The Fayetteville City Council convenes at 6 o'clock tomorrow evening at the City Administration Building on Mountain Street. A federal judge on Friday struck down major provisions of Arkansas's 12-week abortion ban. The law was enacted during last year's state legislative session despite a veto by Governor Mike Beebe. According to Talk Business Arkansas, U.S. District Judge Susan Weber Wright struck down much of the law, ruling that viability rather than a heartbeat is the key factor in whether an abortion should be allowed. Wright didn't completely strike down the law, though. Her decision allows the provision that requires a doctor to check for a fetal heartbeat and to notify a pregnant woman if a heartbeat is present. Two area colleges have formalized an agreement to make student transfers easier. According to the City Wire, Northwest Arkansas Community College and Ecclesia College in Springdale signed a transfer agreement Friday. The agreement means NWAC students can transfer 60 associate degree hours with a grade of C or higher into either the Bachelor of Science in Business Administration or the Sports Management degree programs at Ecclesia College. An endowed professorship at the University of Arkansas has received additional funding from its namesake. Ansel and Virginia Condrey of Dallas have pledged $240,000 to support the endowed professorship in chemical engineering. The professorship was created during the campaign for the 21st century. According to the university, the gift will also provide support to the College of Engineering through the Dean's Advisory Council Fund. Beginning tomorrow, part of a street near downtown Fayetteville will be closed for utilities work. According to the city, the eastbound lane of Halsell Road between Cross and Oliver Avenues will be closed during daytime hours to allow for the installation of a water main. The work is expected to last 10 weekdays, and the street will be open on evenings and during weekends. The City of Harrison has issued a boil order this morning for all city residents living south of the fairgrounds. According to the city, the boil order is a result of a waterline break last night. The Razorback baseball team won one of three on the road in Florida this weekend. Arkansas dropped Friday's game 2-1 and lost again on Saturday with a final score of 1-0. But Arkansas came back yesterday with a 9-3 win. The road series marked the beginning of SEC play for the Razorbacks, who are now 9-7 on the season. Tonight's weather forecast calls for mostly clear skies with lows from 35 in northwest Arkansas to 39 in the Arkansas River Valley. Mostly sunny tomorrow with highs from 66 to 70. And tomorrow night, expect mostly clear conditions with lows from 34 to 39. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas has the details on 1,000 new jobs for Arkansas in his weekly business and political news update.
Pico Foods will locate a fully integrated poultry processing network in northeast Arkansas. A $165 million investment expected to create 1,000 new jobs. The new facilities will include a hatchery, feed mill, and processing plant in Randolph and Clay counties. Walmart's chief financial officer, Charles Holly, told a group of investors that the retailer failed in three of its five main operating objectives last year: sales growth, leveraging its expenses, and operating income growth. And while he promised the retailer will do more to leverage expenses this year, Holly said the biggest focus from its U.S., Sam's Club, and international segments will be to improve dismal same-store sales. Lockheed Martin's received a $255 million contract from the U.S. Army, which will benefit the company's Camden, Arkansas facility. The contract is for a series of rocket systems. The company said work will be performed at Lockheed Martin facilities in Camden and in Dallas, Texas. The U.S. Department of Defense awarded Tyson Foods a three-year contract worth a maximum of $444 million to supply chicken to the federal government. Tyson was chosen from a group of nine offers received through a competitive bid process. Hot Springs leaders are initiating public hearings and a community-wide effort to plan what's next for historic downtown Hot Springs in the wake of a major fire that destroyed the landmark Majestic Hotel. The Hot Springs Chamber of Commerce and its economic development partner organization, the Metro Partnership, have commissioned a Downtown Development Strategy Task Force, which will host a series of public hearings in April to gather ideas and information that can be put into use in an action plan that the group's going to present to the community later in the month. Arkansas lawmakers passed budget bills to support $5 billion in state spending in the next fiscal year. Legislators will meet next Wednesday to officially end the session. A procedural motion known as sine die, which will bring the fiscal session to a close. The crucial piece of legislation passed during the 2014 fiscal session was funding for the private option. Other major funding changes in 2014 included more money for education and prisons, broadband internet for schools, and setting aside nearly $100 million in money from a budget surplus. Finally, former Arkansas Treasurer Martha Shaffner found guilty on all 14 counts of bribery and extortion she was facing from federal prosecutors. Shaffner, whose jury trial began last week, was proven to have taken $36,000 from bond broker Steele Stevens in exchange for state business. She still faces a trial on additional allegations concerning money received related to her campaign account. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business and Politics update.
Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large is provided by AT&T, encouraging drivers to take the pledge to never text and drive. No text is worth the risk. More information at itcanwait.com.
Hi, my name is Paul, your host for the Generic Blue Show, where local and international artists get showcased for over 22 years. You know, anymore, the blues casts a wide net. As new generations emerge, the look and the sound of the blues continues to evolve. Tune in every Friday night at 9 o'clock to see what I've captured next on listener-supported KUAF. We'll see you then.
This is Ozarks at Large. Tyson Foods is an American business success story. The Springdale-based company has revolutionized how the country buys and eats chicken. The company is the subject of a new book by Christopher Leonard titled The Meat Racket, The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business. Leonard covered Tyson Foods and other business interests in Northwest Arkansas while he was a reporter for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette's Northwest Arkansas Bureau. Since he left that paper, he's had his work published in Fortune, Slate, and the New York Times. In his new book, he traces how the company grew from a family business, how some farmers are dissatisfied with their relationship, and how the business of poultry farming has changed over the past few decades. Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums recently talked with Christopher Leonard about the book. He also asked Tyson Foods for a response, and we'll hear that response later on this edition of Ozarks at Large. During their conversation, Kyle asked Christopher Leonard what attracted him to devoting time to a book-length examination of the poultry business.
I had even written about Tyson a little bit before I came to Arkansas when I was a reporter up in Missouri back in the late 90s, and just, you know, walking into a chicken farm for the first time was an incredible experience for me and really memorable to be in one of these giant factory houses with 25,000 birds on the ground. I was just always fascinated with this system. And when I got down to Arkansas, it gave me a chance to report it even more. And it's just sort of the more I encountered it, the more I got interested in it. But I think what you could say really, really did launch this book was back in 2004 when I went down to cover the story in Waldron. There were reports in the morning news, actually, you'll recall, that there was a problem with the Tyson Foods hatchery down there, and these sick birds were being delivered to contract farmers. So it's just an interesting story, and I knew that the way the business was structured, some of the risk really was shifted down to the farmers. But I was deeply, deeply struck by what I saw down in Waldron and reporting down there. And really what struck me was just how much power Tyson had in that town. I was driving around to a lot of these chicken farmers, just interviewing them about what had happened and what was going on their farms, and it was remarkable to me. I mean, you know that farmers are pretty independent folks. They're up by their bootstraps kind of people, but there was this palpable atmosphere of fear around the company. I mean, people were afraid that their neighbors would find out I was on their property. I remember one guy I interviewed in his front yard who he was raising two kids. His farm was in trouble, and he just would slump his shoulders. He was scared to give me his name. He was scared to talk about what was happening, and I just thought, wow, there is something really important going on here. And that's, you know, really what launched the reporting for this book. I just wanted to learn more about how the system really worked and how it got to be the way it is today.
In the middle third of the book, you take us from the beginnings with the first John Tyson and through and how it developed. But you start the book with this with a family that lives in Scott County in Waldron, the Yandells, and they are you're with them in the process of their career as farmers ending.
Yeah. That was sort of ground zero for the whole thing. Jerry and Kenita Yandell, I went down there as the reporting trip I just talked about. I met with Kenita. Jerry was actually off trying to make some money working in California at that time. And it was such a sad story to me. I mean, this was a family who'd been working since they were little kids. I mean, Jerry Yandell is a guy who grew up working on as a migrant laborer in California on vegetable and fruit farms. He knew how to work. And they had gotten into chicken raising in their teens and had been in business for 20 years and had built a really decent middle-class life there in Waldron. They were big-time chicken farmers. They had several chicken houses. They were working 7 days a week. And they were literally wiped out and put out of business in 2004 because three consecutive flocks of terribly diseased birds were delivered to their farm. And again, it just struck me that here you've got this family that's really built a pretty solid middle-class life, and it was all wiped out in just a matter of months. I mean, that's all it took. That's how close these people were to the edge, and that's how vulnerable they were economically. And they are truly representative of modern-day poultry farmers. They're not an outlying case. And so, yeah, their story really shines a light on the economics of the business for the farmer.
So the profit margin is very shallow for the farmers who raise and sell the birds to Tyson, correct?
Correct.
Or any poultry giant, I imagine, for that matter.
Yes.
This is not just... You talk about what Tyson has built in a vertical integration. And I've heard that term before, but explain once again what vertical integration is.
Sure, you bet. The best way to understand it is picture a Tyson Foods plant in a little town where they're raising poultry. And by the way, we're talking big business here. Raising meat is still the economic pillar of a lot of these communities. It's the economic lifeblood. And so you'll have this giant Tyson Foods plant on the north end of town. And inside this facility, you will have what used to be independent businesses on Main Street. You'll have a giant feed mill, a hatchery, an enormous slaughterhouse, a trucking line. All these businesses have been sucked into a single silo of corporate control. They've been integrated. So Tyson Foods owns and operates all the inputs, all the components that used to supply and used to sort of support a rural economy of chicken production. And the system was invented back in the 40s in the South by Tyson Foods and other poultry companies that realized, of course, there could be great efficiencies to be achieved when they could sort of have this command and control approach to chicken production. They would make their own feed. They raised their own birds. They delivered the birds to a farm and picked them up. The farmer never owns the birds. And it allowed chicken to become produced in this incredibly efficient system that made chicken go from being sort of a specialty meat that was pretty expensive to being what it is today, which is the cheapest meat relative to other meats and America's most popular meat.
The story of how Tyson becomes this corporate giant is so compelling. Of course, it starts in the Depression when John Tyson comes south and doesn't have much to his name. He's traveling a lot. Sometimes his son Don has to stay with a neighbor or somebody else. You talk about an up from the bootstraps sort of story. That's where Tyson begins.
It is. It's truly, truly remarkable. I don't think we have people in America anymore that are like Don Tyson, that were born in that sort of environment of very limited means, a town that was certainly on the economic periphery of America at the time, right? Springdale, Arkansas, 1931. And Don Tyson, as you said, sort of lived at his father's feet in terms of business. I mean, at night they would sit around the family dinner table and talk business, and Don's stepmom would be keeping the company's books on a ledger. He grew up in this world. He understood the business. But what is truly, truly remarkable to me was that you could have a guy like Don Tyson who took over the company when his dad tragically passed away in 1967. And at that time, Don inherited what was just a regional poultry firm. There were lots like it. It wasn't a titan by any means. And over the decades, he, of course, helped turn it into the world's biggest meat company. It expanded But what is really fascinating to me is that he had a mind that could perpetually adapt to growth on a huge level. I mean, to go from being a regional poultry guy in the 70s to being somebody who was welcome in the Oval Office when Bill Clinton was president, who rubbed shoulders with the biggest CEOs of corporate agribusiness, who was a billionaire, who ran a company with almost unprecedented reach in U.S. meat production. It's an incredible story, and he was certainly one of the most, I think, underappreciated business figures of modern American business.
One of my favorite stories that you write about is that for years, people, when he was president, chairman of the company, people might not know where he was. He was in Illinois courting McDonald's, trying to convince them to sell, put chicken on their menu, and this at a time long before the McNugget, when they sold hamburgers, but he saw fast food as a place to grow.
Yes, he was a visionary that way. I mean, back in the 60s, chicken just wasn't on the menu. A hamburger was kind of the perfect fast food meat. But what Don Tyson realized was that because of the vertical integration and the industrialization of the chicken business, they could make a pound of chicken more cheaply than either beef or pork. And he knew that those economic forces would make it all but inevitable that chicken would get on the menu. But back at that time, the whole concept of a chicken sandwich was just bizarre, let alone nobody had fathomed or seen the McNugget yet. And yes, he was relentless in going to McDonald's, rejection after rejection. He worked over 12 years telling them, you know, you need to do this. And then finally, some food scientists invented the McNugget, and Don Tyson was there at the exact right moment and right time to seize the opportunity, and he had this vertically integrated company behind him. So what he could do that was amazing was go to McDonald's and say, you give me your order, I will turn around and retrofit an entire farming system to fill that order. I can control the slaughterhouse, I can control the farms, I can control the genetics of the bird, and we will fulfill your order. So that's when they really exploded and took off, was with the sort of advent of the nugget and the tender.
You mentioned that the business press hasn't covered Tyson as much as they have other companies because it's not as sexy, it's not as interesting. It's from a Wall Street perspective, sometimes boring.
Yeah, and I really fault the business press for that. I would like to point out the Arkansas Democrat Gazette's not guilty of that. It's a great state newspaper. But having been a business reporter for a long time, there is a really unhealthy obsession with the daily churn of the stock market. That just seems to be the main story of all the business press. And I kind of liken it to the financial journalism equivalent of kitten videos on YouTube. It's easy, it's sexy, you get it, it's a quick story. Hey, Apple stock is up today because of rumors of a new iPhone. But when you're so obsessed with that daily stuff because it's easy to cover, you can really lose sight of some of the important systemic changes that are happening in our economy that really affect people, that really affect consumers who eat meat, for example, and farmers who raise it. And I think that there's a lack of interest and a lack of willingness to kind of dig deep into these institutional stories as opposed to covering the stock market churn. And yeah, for that reason, you know, Tyson Foods is a transformative company. It's a very powerful company in the United States, but they're not going to invent a new iPhone. So they're not going to move the stock market in a given day. And because of that, they really don't get the scrutiny that they warrant.
You talk to farmers, you talk to people who used to be farmers, but you also talk to people who used to work inside corporate headquarters. And I think you might have talked to some people who currently work, though they didn't want to be identified. What was the reporting like when you were talking to people who were deeper into the company?
I think I was really fortunate to interview a lot of people who helped build the company over decades, including Don Tyson, his close advisor and friend for many decades, Jim Blair, who's an attorney, clearly, easily one of the most intelligent, remarkable people I've ever met in my life. And I think that these people were proud, justifiably proud of what they'd built over decades. And I think they also felt Tyson Foods was an underappreciated story and a story that was misunderstood. And they were eager to talk about it. They were eager to share what they had done and share their story. Now, if I could, ask myself a question here, which is, well, gosh, what do they think of the book, you know?
Have you heard?
I haven't heard directly from a lot of these folks. And I can't imagine that they're happy with a lot of my conclusions. But, you know, what was reported is the accurate and whole picture as I was best able to attain it. And I think that sometimes when you work at the center of a company or at the top, the thing is so big that you can miss what's happening at the bottom and on the fringes and some of the realities on the ground of the system that's been created. So, you know, I tried to represent the brilliance at the heart of Tyson Foods and the transformative nature of the company, but also what I think are some really troubling problems with how powerful it is today.
It seems that when you read The Meat Racket, you're not only reading about the poultry industry, you're not only reading about Tyson Foods, but you're reading about a conversation about free enterprise and profit and business, because Tyson was built on smarts, it was built on risk-taking, and it was built on acquisition and getting bigger. And that has been rewarded, but there have been people who, it seems, have also suffered because of that.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's a paradox, and it's kind of hard to wrap your head around as a business reporter, the fact that, you know, free enterprise and competition and innovation led to the creation of Tyson Foods. And by and large, you know, nobody handed Don Tyson anything, although I would point out the company really benefited from federal subsidies of many kinds over the decades. But, you know, the company was built through the kind of smarts you're talking about. But one of the paradoxes of competitive markets and capitalism is that firms can get so big that they pass this point whereby they actually gain really profound market power. And when companies gain enough power to affect markets, they can start to distort the laws of supply and demand. And then you start having problems with competition in the business. It's a trend we've seen play out again and again in American history. And that's why antitrust laws that kind of curb this and try to reinstitute competition. Well, shoot, antitrust laws have been around for centuries. And they were codified, you know, in the early 1900s, late 1800s for a reason. We realized you had to keep markets moving in a way that kept them competitive. And I think it's one of the great ironies of Tyson Foods and the handful of giant competitors that are left today, like Cargill and Smithfield and JBS, is that they were born in competitive markets, but when you look at the meat system today, it really is defined by centralization and command and control economics and not transparent markets or competition. Just a tiny example, I mean, Tyson Foods can control production on about 4,000 chicken farms from one office in Springdale. That's a centralized control system. It's not a bunch of independent entrepreneurs making independent decisions, the kind of give and take you think of for open markets.
At the end of your part of the book, you include a statement from Tyson because you had detailed questions for them when you were done with your part, and you wanted them to respond. And to some, they did respond, and you include that in the text of the book. But what they didn't respond to necessarily, specifically, you included in the statement from them, they suggest that you talk to a few disgruntled farmers who had bad experiences, which is what will happen in a competitive work environment, and that it's not representative.
Sure, and I just really disagreed with that assessment pretty strongly for a few reasons. And where do I start? I mean, first of all, I'll acknowledge some of the people I interviewed were disgruntled. And you know what? I'd be pretty disgruntled, too, if I had gone through what they went through. But you can hardly call Don Tyson, Haskell Jackson, and Jim Blair disgruntled former employees. I mean, these are the people that built the company. Their stories are represented in a full, fair way throughout the book. But, you know, if the farmers I interviewed who had a bad deal were outliers or, you know, bad apples in a big bunch, then I wouldn't have written the book. It is clear, and there's overwhelming evidence, these people are representative of the realities in the chicken business. And if people certainly shouldn't take my word for it, you can go online. There was a series of unprecedented workshops between the Department of Justice and Department of Agriculture. And they went on a listening tour around the country, and there's a huge body of documentary evidence that they left on the internet that shows systemic, industry-wide abuses of the kind I document in the book, and that I've been researching this for years. There are lawsuits around the country, case after case of this stuff happening. So they're representative cases, and You know, I think the National Chicken Council, or no, it was the American Meat Institute, they said Chris Leonard's only getting one side of the story. I mean, geez, you read the book, half of it is a history of Tyson Foods told by the people inside the company. It's not one side of the story.
Finally, I have to ask, you lived and worked in Northwest Arkansas for a while. You now live in Washington, D.C. After this book, you've been interviewed by NPR, MSNBC, others. Do you get a sense that people outside of Northwest Arkansas understand that you have one of the most influential food companies in the world? You have the world's largest retailer in this little, small area. Is there a sense, I guess I'm asking, in the business world, what is happening and the influences from Northwest Arkansas?
No. There's not, and it's unbelievable. You've got two of the most influential companies in the United States and arguably on planet Earth based in Northwest Arkansas, Tyson Foods and Walmart Stores. And the impact and scope of what they're doing is totally underappreciated by the national press, which unfortunately is increasingly isolated on the coasts because of the downturn in the journalism business, where they have cut reporters aggressively in the Midwest. And I think it's a deeply misunderstood story, undercovered, underappreciated. I think every national outlet that covers business has got to have a bureau in Northwest Arkansas. You understand Walmart, you understand modern retail. You understand Tyson Foods, you're understanding the modern food system. And these companies are giants. When they move, it makes ripples that affect everybody else. And it is just absolutely underreported and undercovered.
Christopher Leonard is the author of the new book, The Meat Racket: The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business. He talked to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums last month and is a former business reporter for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette's Northwest Arkansas Bureau. He now lives in the Washington, D.C. area. Kyle Kellums asked Tyson Foods to respond to the book and the interview, and Gary Mickelson, the senior director for public relations at the company, had this response.
Chris Leonard's book is not like a newspaper story that tries to tell both sides. It's really his view of our company in the meat business. And unfortunately, some of his view is misleading and not accurate. The truth is, Tyson Foods is one of the leading supporters of American farmers. When you take a look at the last year alone, we paid more than $15 billion to the independent farmers who supply us. We depend on them, and we want them to succeed. And frankly, we believe most of them are satisfied with their relationship with our company. Some of these farmers have been raising livestock and poultry for us for decades, and in some cases, for multiple generations. Our business is set up to meet the needs of our customers with safe, affordable food. We sell our products to grocery stores, to restaurants, and others, and the prices that we set are determined by basic supply and demand. There's no one company big enough to control the market, especially in today's global food environment. Meat production is already one of the most heavily regulated industries in the country, but for us, it's not just about regulations, it's about people. People trying to do the right thing in every aspect of what we do, including how we work with farmers. You know, Mr. Leonard talks about the loss of chickens in Waldron, Arkansas 10 years ago. Our recollection is different than his. Contrary to his claim, the birds were not sick when they were delivered to the farm. They contracted viruses after they arrived on the farm. Fortunately, the poultry industry has since learned how to do a better job controlling these viruses through better on-farm management practices. And speaking of Waldron, we'd like to make a couple of points. Tyson bought an existing vertically integrated poultry business there from another company in 1984. We're proud to be a part of the Waldron community and the benefits we believe our business brings. You know, when we combine our annual payroll, our payments to poultry farmers, what we pay for local services and taxes, we estimate we generate an annual economic benefit of more than $60 million in the Waldron, Arkansas area.
Gary Mickelson is the Senior Director for Public Relations at Tyson Foods. Christopher Leonard, the author of the book The Meat Racket, said in an email to Ozarks at Large, he stands by the reporting in the book and that the book is based on the record interviews and Tyson documents. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Last month, Revy Brock from our content partner Talk Business sat down with the CEO of Tyson Foods, Donnie Smith, for a conversation that will be the feature story in the next issue of Talk Business Arkansas magazine. Here is a portion of that conversation.
Let's begin with just kind of your career at Tyson Foods. You started in 1980. You graduated from the University of Tennessee. Kind of appropriate that you got some close to Tennessee colors in there.
Yeah, I love it. They did that.
Maybe a little more Razorback red. Well, close. I don't know. We'll see. But just tell me how did you land your first job with Tyson Foods? What were you doing, and how did you come to the company?
Yeah, I was a pre-vet major at Tennessee. And after about a year and a half, maybe 2 years, I figured out that was not going to work. And my college advisor, who was also the poultry science extension guy at Tennessee, Dr. Goen, I went to him and said, "It's not going to work, is it?" He said, "Not a chance." And I was using Poultry Science Club to pad my resume because I figured if I couldn't get in with grades, if I had a long resume, they might look at me, but it wasn't going to happen. And so he kind of pointed me towards Tyson because they had a complex in Shelbyville, which was about an hour and a half from where I grew up. And so I started working them really hard my last year of school. And by the time I graduated, Terry and I met my wife at school too. We graduated on the 12th of December. We got married on the 20th of December, and I started to work for Tyson on the 28th of December as a broiler service man, you know, calling on growers and trying to help them do as good a job as they could do growing chickens.
Let's talk about the last 12, 18 months here at Tyson Foods. Things are clicking on all cylinders, and things are really moving in the right direction. And why do you think things have aligned like they have?
Two things. One, we spent really since 2009, you know, from that point till now, really working on our culture. And I think creating a culture where, you know, people are willing to take some risks, not crazy risks, but, you know, reasonable, controlled risks, not afraid to fail, knowing that you know, we got to try different things, we got to try to innovate, and everything about our business, our processes in our plants, our processes here as we, you know, manage through the everyday business of taking orders and paying for stuff and all that. And so just really creating a culture where people know that we care about them, and they're willing to take a chance and try something new and that kind of thing.
Give me an example of something that fits that mold that you can think of.
Sure. So I remember, I'm going to date myself a little bit. This is kind of going back into that 2009, 2010 era. In our fresh chicken business, we had really light truck weights. You know, we were probably averaging 24,000 pounds a truck. And so, you know, we're scratching our heads around how can we be more efficient. And we just made the decisions. Look, the customer service representatives, they deal with our customers every day. They take these orders, and they build the orders into truckloads. Wouldn't they be the best ones to figure out, you know, how to increase transportation efficiency? And so we just brought them in and said, "Hey, here's where we are. Here's where we think we could be. So what do you think?" And they go, "Oh, yeah." And it was more of a, you know, kind of, we were just waiting for you to ask. And so we turned them loose on that. And some of it was order pattern changes. Some of it was working with production plant scheduling folks. But now we average close to 34,000 pounds of load in that business. And you know, the bosses didn't do that. It was the bosses turning the people loose and saying, "Look, try some new stuff, because mm-hmm. what we're doing today is not as good as it could be." Mm-hmm. And I think that's a great example of just, you know, dropping down to the people who are the closest to the work and explaining to them what we would like to be able to do, and get us as close to that as you can. And it's amazing what people will do.
Yeah.
So there's one quick, I could talk the rest of the day on examples.
So changing culture is one aspect. You said there's a second.
You know, a lot of where we are today has really been built on the foundation that we started in FY 10 and 11 and 12, which was really getting our cost structure right and our capital structure right. Getting back to the fundamental basics, blocking and tackling of running a good business.
What was out of line before that? I mean,
I'll just use our poultry business, for example. We've probably taken close to 10 cents a pound out of our poultry business. And it was in line efficiency, labor efficiency, plant spend, yields. So I'm not talking about pricing or I'm not talking about the change in grain. I'm talking about things that we had complete control over that we just weren't focusing on at the time. I'll get a quick story, and this will really hurt her 20 minutes thing, but I remember not long after they had put me in this job, I brought the senior team together and said, okay, we're going to have our first strategy talk, and here's our strategy. We're not going to talk about strategy for at least a year. We don't need a strategy. We need to fix this business. So I want to just forget about grandiose ideas about who we can be in 5 years, because if we don't fix this thing, there ain't going to be 5 years. Just go get good at what we do. And, 2010, best year we've ever had. We got really focused on the fundamentals of our business. And we've never lost sight of that and the importance of that. And so that's a big part of it. And we took those earnings and had a lot of choices, to use that cash. But what we did is we really fixed our balance sheet. And now our net debt to EBITDA is like 0.6 times. We've got a great balance sheet. We've got a lot of options in how we use our cash. And so our folks today, really what they're reaping today is the benefit of all that hard work from 10 and 11 and 12. Our sales folks are focused on working with our customers. I think God gave us two ears and one mouth for a reason, so we try to shut up and listen. It's hard to tell through this because I'm talking like a machine gun, but listen to our customers and find out what it means to be their go-to supplier, and then just come back and go to work on how can we help add value to their business, because when we do that, then that adds value to our business. Mm-hmm.
Roby Brock talked to Donnie Smith, the CEO of Tyson Foods, earlier this year. The conversation is the cover subject for the next issue of Talk Business Arkansas magazine. Roby and Talk Business Arkansas are content partners of Ozarks at Large.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs. Junior Parker was born Herman Parker on March 3, 1927, in West Memphis in Crittenden County. Young Herman became interested in music at a young age, which may not be surprising, as wide-open West Memphis served the partying populace of the region as equally as did Beale Street across the river in Memphis. By the time he was a teenager, billed as Little Junior Parker, Herman was playing harmonica in what may have been one of the most influential bands in American music, that of Howlin' Wolf. Wolf perfected his sound while based in West Memphis, and though he is rightfully called a progenitor of the Chicago-style blues, Wolf called it the West Memphis style. Like Howlin' Wolf, Parker had a show on West Memphis radio station KWEN. Ike Turner heard Parker playing on the radio and recorded him in the early 1950s. Junior Parker also mentored under Helena-based Sonny Boy Williamson II, a.k.a. Rice Miller, and deep blues fans can hear the similarities in their harmonica styles. I told him, whoa! Feels so good. We're gonna boogie till the break of day. Although Memphis's Sun Records is world famous for its mid-1950s rock and roll discoveries such as Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, and Arkansas-er Johnny Cash, less celebrated is Sun's early 1950s blues period. Such Arkansas-connected blues artists as Auburn Pat Hare, James Cotton, harmonica Frank Floyd, and Dr. Ross all saw releases on the label. The most important were probably those by Junior Parker's old boss, Howlin' Wolf. But Junior Parker had his own successes on Sun Records. Feeling Good, heard here, is from his first session. Parker reportedly didn't care for the simplistic boogie song. He preferred Uptown R&B. But producer Sam Phillips asked the group for something rougher. Phillips was right. Feeling Good hit the R&B top five in the fall of 1953 as by Little Junior's Blue Flames. Mystery Train, Parker's other Sun Records release, was redone by Sun performer Elvis Presley 2 years later and has become a classic. In 1954, Junior Parker left town and Sun Records for Houston, Texas, with guitarist and Cherry Valley native Auburn Pat Hare. Parker and Bobby Blue Bland toured together as a package show, with Hare supporting. Johnny Ace was also part of the review until he shot himself backstage playing Russian Roulette in 1954. Parker and Bland continued touring together from the mid-1950s to 1961. Even after leaving the Duke Records package tour, Parker continued to maintain a grueling touring schedule, fronting his own Junior Parker Review. He also maintained a presence on the rhythm and blues record charts. Junior Parker eventually dissolved his Review, but continued touring through the 1960s. Junior Parker, R&B hitmaker, and writer of at least two iconic songs, who has been called the creator of black rockabilly, died during brain surgery in Chicago, Illinois, on November 18, 1971. He was 45 years old. Here in its entirety is Crittenden County native Junior Parker with the original Mystery Train, released on Memphis's Sun Records, November 1st, 1953, as by Little Junior's Blue Flames. West Memphis native Junior Parker with the original Mystery Train from 1953 on Memphis's Sun Records as by Little Junior's Blue Flames. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. For more information, visit arkansongs.org.
It is Monday, March 17th, 2014, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda, and joining me now is Becca Martin-Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. Why? Why must you always pinch?
Because you don't have on green. It's St. Patrick's Day.
It is.
I don't pinch hard.
No.
I don't have on green either, but they can't see that, so. We are going to do Music Monday.
Okay.
I think this may become a regular thing.
I like it.
Talk about some things coming up this week. Of course, that means that I am channeling Kevin Kinder, the music writer for What's Up, so mm-hmm. I won't sound a thing like him. There's a band from Cincinnati called Tweens.
Really?
And they play trash pop.
That makes sense.
Touring the country in between South by Southwest and Austin, you know, on the way back. Mm-hmm. They have a self-titled full-length album ready to go in April. And they will perform tomorrow night at the Lightbulb Club in Fayetteville. Show starts at 10 o'clock. Yeah, 10 o'clock
at night.
Too
late for you?
Oh, yeah. And admission is $5. A little earlier in the night, on Thursday, Antonella Gazzoli, a soprano from Tuscany, Italy, is going to perform at the Walmart Auditorium at the Shoemaker Center at Northwest Arkansas Community College in Bentonville.
Yes, heard about this.
Apparently, she is quite something.
That's what I've heard.
And she is going to be doing works by Mozart, Schubert, Strauss, and Puccini, and it is...
free.
Exactly. 7 o'clock Thursday at NWAC. Another band that Kevin recommends is Blackberry Smoke. They were at Mulberry Mountain with the Zac Brown Band, apparently a member of the Zac Brown Band's record label.
Oh, okay.
And they will be playing on their Fire in the Hole tour Thursday night at George's Majestic Lounge. It's their first gig in the United States following several in Europe. The show starts at 9 o'clock. It's a little bitter. And admission is $17.50. And also on Thursday at 9 o'clock at Smoke and Barrel Tavern in Fayetteville, Nora Jane Struthers and the Party Line, an Americana quintet.
She's a lot of fun.
Saw them at Roots Festival.
Mm-hmm.
Did you love them?
They're really fun.
Admission's $5. Where else could you spend $5 better?
I don't know. Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is Features Editor, Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, a new documentary that looks at the intense grilling Anita Hill faced from the Senate when she claimed Clarence Thomas sexually harassed her.
Why in God's name would you ever speak to a man like that the rest of your life?
That's a very good question.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Here and Now, coming up next here on KUAF 91.3 FM. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Waldron. Few quick sports notes before we end today's show. The Arkansas men's basketball team will play in the National Invitational Tournament this week. Arkansas opens the 32-team tournament at home against Indiana State tomorrow night at 8. If the Razorbacks win, they'll face the winner of California and Utah Valley State. The men's basketball game tomorrow night means the Arkansas baseball game will start earlier than scheduled. Arkansas and Grambling will now begin their game at Baum Stadium at 5:05 tomorrow. The Arkansas men's track team ended the indoor track and field season as the number 2 team in the country. Arkansas finished just 8 points behind national champion Oregon this weekend at the national meet in Albuquerque. The Arkansas women's team finished 6th in the country at the meet. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Thanks so much for listening. Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. Have a happy St. Patrick's Day.